I don't think Jesus came to save souls. I think He came to restore them. I believe Jesus came to teach us about God, and we've ended up arguing over the things the church has taught us about Jesus. Maybe the best way to restore the church is not for us to reinvent it, but rather remember what is distinctive and radical about us as Jesus' people. The ones who first practiced radical hospitality and nonviolence and a communitarian ethic that threatened the mighty Roman Empire. But to do this first, we need a new premise in the church. And I've been fascinated lately with all the assumed major premises in the church. Those doctrines we've been taught to assume are true, but maybe are not. And the granddaddy of them all is original sin. When you think about it, most of us argue over our conclusions, whether in religion or in politics, but not many of us discuss the assumptions that underlie those arguments. Assumptions about the very nature of reality that makes certain conclusions inevitable. Human beings may not be born bad or born into sin, as the church puts it. That first premise determines the outcome of all the orthodox Christian arguments. But what if it's not true? Matthew Fox was a theologian. He came up with the concept of people as the original blessing versus original sin in the 1980s when I was attending seminary. But he got it, I think, from the Christian mystics of the Middle Ages. I've come to believe that, like so many other so-called essential doctrines of the church, original sin is an invention of the institution. Take original sin. The idea that we're born into sin, that we inherited it from our first parents, Adam and Eve. That we arrive in the world as little sinners, little bitty sinners trapped by the transgressions of those who came before us. Because sin is a birthright, like red hair or left-handedness. It says we sin because we're sinners rather than we are sinners because we sin. Now that's no small distinction. Original sin renders us helpless. Original blessing says we have a choice. And you've got to hand it to the church. They provided humanity with a diagnosis for a disease for which they had the only cure. That would be the ultimate spiritual franchise. You see, if you can keep the masses from challenging your assumed premises, you have enormous power. I mean, take the divine right of kings. It enslaved humanity for centuries until someone got up and said the king is not divine. The emperor has no clothes. We have a wonderful story here in Genesis in which the mythical couple Adam and Eve, who have everything they need but not everything they want, choose to sin. And they get us all kicked out of the garden. Now, I call that a myth not because it's not true, but because it contains a truth larger than mere facts can convey. The instructions to Adam and Eve are clear enough. Do as you please, but don't do one thing. Don't eat the fruit of one tree in the middle of the garden, or you will die. Nonsense, says the serpent. Go for it. It'll open your eyes. You'll be more like God, knowing good and evil. So the woman partakes, and she recommends it to Adam, the little temptress. And immediately they realize they're naked. In other words, they discover shame. But the best part of the story is the passing of the buck. When confronted with this transgression, Adam blames the woman who blames the serpent. It's the first example of the victimhood mentality, where no one is ever to blame for anything. Etiology is a medical term applied to the idea of the origins of disease, but it's also a literary device in the search for origins of another kind, in which a story is created retroactively to explain how things came to be, which is exactly what the story of Adam and Eve does. Looking around, the author of that story saw this desperately imperfect and broken world and wondered, how did it get that way? If God is really all-powerful and all-loving, then how did God create such a flawed and tragic creature like us? You can't blame an imperfect world on a perfect God. But this much is certain. We all do things we're told expressly not to do. And there are some realities in life that seem particularly unfair. That women should give birth in great pain and sometimes die in childbirth. And that men should work by the sweat of their brows until they die. You see, the story serves to explain why what is. Once we were perfect, frolicking blissfully in paradise, God's work was perfect. But then, because we chose to sin, we now have to suffer the consequences. We've been kicked out of the garden, or to quote John Steinbeck's novel, We All Live East of Eden. But the story doesn't say that we sin because we can't help ourselves. It says we often choose to sin and then suffer the consequences. It really wasn't until centuries later that the church created the doctrine of original sin. Primarily, it was Augustine's doing, and he never did completely reconcile body and soul. And he essentially took free will away from us when it came to sinning. We're just helpless, hopeless until we get Jesus, which eliminates all sinning. For as Christians, we never sin. Okay, we still sin, but now we're forgiven. You've seen the bumper stickers. I'm not perfect, just forgiven. They call it original sin. We're just doing the same old stupid, nasty stuff all the time. Because we can't help ourselves. I saw a sign in front of a church some years ago that announced the sermon title, If You're Done With Sin, Then Come On In. But as I got closer to the sign, I saw someone had written another message just underneath it, in smaller letters that looked like lipstick. It said, But if you're not quite through, call 272. So what if Matthew Fox is right? What if we were born not into original sin, but as an original blessing? Here's what I believe. Over the centuries, the church has unwittingly been a part of a grand ecclesiastical put-down of the human race. We have so focused so much of our energy on teaching people to be humble that we've forgotten how to embrace the idea that we were born in the image of God, captured by that beautiful Latin phrase, Imago Dei, made in the image of God. That's our original first premise. We so distrust our own goodness, our real birthright, Imago Dei, that the word human has now been joined with a certain given weakness or fallibility. A baseball player strikes out not because the pitcher threw the perfect curveball, but because the batter's only human. Your grandmother, the one who bakes the perfect cakes, the perfect three-layered jobs that come out of the oven like a work of art and taste like sunshine in your mouth. But one day something goes wrong. Nobody's perfect. And the cake falls. And what does she say? Well, I'm only human. Well, what I want to know is this. What was she when she baked the perfect cake? What was the baseball player when he hit the grand slam or made that diving catch? We want to talk about our humanness as a way of explaining failure, but not as a way to explain success. It's original sin over original blessing again. To err is human, to forgive divine. See how the pie is sliced? Humans also forgive, do they not? I mean, most children don't start out their lives afflicted with excessive and crippling humility. They don't come into the world all stooped over from self-loathing. They have to have that drilled into them. Let me tell you a story. When I was in my first year of seminary, the church of my field education had a college group that had an annual Christmas project, and these were mostly my contemporaries. And so the group set out to spread some love and joy, but we never thought for one minute that we were being condescending about it. We made baskets for the poor, and then we dared to go into what we called the ghetto in those days to distribute them. Called the Department of Social Services, and we asked them, who are the poor in our community? And they gave us a list of needy families. We bought fruit and candy and apples and oranges and bananas, and we put them in a basket, and we tied a big bow on top and put a little card in there with a Hallmark verse about the true meaning of Christmas, and off we went. We knew how important it was to be humble, because the whole Christmas's story is humble, right? So this is how we did it. First, we would go up to the porch with the basket and knock on the door. And when we heard the person who lived there was coming, we'd yell, "Merry Christmas," and we'd run and jump in the car and drive on to the next stop. We weren't really interested in making contact. We were just making a delivery. Well, it was my turn to go and make the delivery, and the neighborhood was downright depressing. And I walked up on the porch and I knocked on the door. Nothing. No response. And so I knocked again. And just to be sure, I knocked one more time. Nothing. Nobody's home. I guess I was almost enjoying the thought. My friends, they were growing impatient. And then suddenly there was a face at the door staring at me through the screen. It was a black face. I had not seen it in the shadows of the evening. But all of a sudden, there he was. And he said, "Hi." I said, "Oh, hi." He said, "What can I do for you?" And I thought to myself, what am I doing now? I'm just trying to leave a basket, and now I'm in a conversation with a real-life poor person? And then another face appeared. This belonged to a woman, and she said, "Hi." And she said, "Won't you come in?" Come in? This is not working out the way I planned. Sure, come in. Why not? And they introduced themselves. "I'm Benjamin Johnson. This is my wife, Claire. And your name?" Who, me? "Oh, I'm Bill Trump from the First Baptist group." Then this little boy appeared from some other part of the house, and his mother introduced him. He looked to be about 9 or 10 years old, and he smiled and said, "What's in the basket?" I'd forgotten I was even holding the basket, and I said, "Oh, here, Merry Christmas," and I handed it to him. He took it from me, and get this, he started getting into the basket, unwrapping the paper and started opening the gift right there instead of waiting until I left. He took out an apple and as if he intended to eat it. And I'm thinking, this stupid kid doesn't know how charity works. This is not working out the way I planned. And he did something totally weird. He got out a second apple and handed it to me. What was I supposed to do? I'm supposed to be humble. So I took it and I took a bite out of it. And they said, "Have a seat." And I sat down on this little stool. And I thought, well, here I am sitting in the home of real-life poor people, eating out of my own basket. But I'll never forget what I learned that day. I learned something as powerful as anything I've ever learned in my life. It shapes my theology, my politics, my family life, my understanding of God. And it's very simple. Until you think about it. And then it's rather astonishing. all of us, and I mean all of us, eat out of the same basket. Not mine and yours, not his and hers, ours and theirs. However we like to hide it behind slogans of the self-made man or manifest destiny or survival of the fittest. The truth is, we all eat out of the same basket. We all eat together. The world is not our project. It's not our opportunity to take from the poor and give to the rich and sanctify our guilt with a little charity. We're all in this together. We've got to stop thinking of ourselves as if some are entitled and others are not. And then recover our true first premise of faith. Imago Dei, made in the image of God. One author called this primal memory, this belief that we are from God. Because the real message of Genesis isn't that we're infected with badness, but that the God who made the plants and the trees and said that it was good, the God that made the light and saw it was good, the God that filled the sea with fish and the sky with birds and saw that it was good. And then God made something else, slowly. He made a creature who could write poetry and sing beautiful music, paint masterpieces and raise Lazarus from the dead. After God made humankind in his own image, it's the only time that God says, not that this is good, but this is very good. And what did God make? You and me. And if we put ourselves down, that's a sin. And not a very original one. When God made you and me and Benjamin and Claire Johnson and their son Timothy and every other human being in the world, God said, this is the very best I can do. So the next time that someone does something truly extraordinary, something good and decent and hopeful, just say, well, she's human. Great, great Kate, Grandma. Well, child, I'm human. Nice catch, Mr. Third Baseman. Well, after all, I'm human. Take a look around this morning. You're sitting next to the image of God. And every time you live up to your inheritance, instead of living down to your sickness, you're recreated in the image of God. And the next time you think you can't do something, just remember, hey, I'm human. When I consider the heavens, the work of God's fingers, the moon and the stars, I think, what are people that God is conscious of us? Women and men and girls and boys, just like us. And the answer comes back clear as a bell. This I have made in my own image, only slightly less than myself. Amen.